don't think there's anything more needed to say, other than we are trying to create a branch monastery in Elika at this stage. It's just a residence for Venerable Mudu and Patrick, but in the future we hope that will be a monastery for training monks here in Mudu.
And nuns.
And nuns.
Yeah.
And nuns.
Yeah.
And that will be Mudu will be the franchisee.
As long as he behaves.
Sorry. That's okay. Thank you for listening.
Very good.
There was one thing.
Yeah.
Steve, you've got to
Oh, sorry. Steve has some gifts he wishes to give to Adam on behalf of the community here. Sorry, Steve.
No, no, it's okay, Harry.
A piece of wood.
It's a bit of wood.
Yeah. Oh, karma will get the bastards.
You have to be careful what you say.
Okay, see ya. Where this comes from is that sometimes that people mistreat you, they do the wrong thing, and sometimes you want to seek revenge. You get angry, and how can I get my own back? You don't need to get your own back, because karma will get the bastards anyway. That's very Australian. But it's true. So, I mean, you can just relax and just, you know, let it be. And that means you don't have to be so upset and other people just do the wrong thing. You can just laugh. There's lots of nice stories. A long time ago... Oh, yeah. Clap. Is that good? That's the synchronized things. A long time ago, there was this gentleman, this is a long time in ancient Greece. And when he got a job, he had a teacher for a long time. When he got a job, people would sometimes criticize him, tell him off unfairly. And when people told him bad things, he would laugh. He would never get angry back. They said, "You're stupid, you don't know what you're doing. You're crazy." And every time he got abused like that, he laughed. Can you do that? Shall we try? No, better not. And they asked, "How can you laugh when people say bad things about you?" And he said, "I was trained, when my teacher trained me like this, whenever he had to tell me off for making a mistake, he would charge me extra fees for tuition. Because it was a lot of stress on the teacher to tell their students off and to say you've made a bad choice or you've got the answer wrong. When you make a mistake, the poor old teacher has to work harder to make sure you learn your mistakes, or learn from your mistakes." So he said, now I've finished my schooling. Now when I make a mistake, I don't have to pay for it. I get it all for free. That's why I think it's very funny. And I always remember that story, because what it means is when something happens to you in life, instead of getting angry and upset, we've got another choice. We can just laugh. You get opportunities. I think I said this story the last time I was here, that sometimes it's the case that when you go home, and you're walking down the road, and you tread in the dog poo. Did I tell that story last time I was here? Yeah, for some of you, yeah. Yeah, but it's also, there's many people here are getting to that sort of age. I can tell the same old stories, and they forget it. So, if you tread in the dog poo, what should you do? No, laugh. No, you don't wipe it off yet. You take it home with you. And not yet. And then you only scrape it off when you get to your garden. And then, that's right, then you can scrape it off under the apple tree. Or if you're from Thailand, under the mango tree. And then 1 year later, 1 year later, you will find that your mangoes or apples are sweeter than ever before. You got all this free fertilizer. Oh, thank you so much. But the trouble is, when people eat the new apple, they forget what they're really eating. What are you really eating? Eating dog poo. Are you transformed into delicious apple or mango? That's where it comes from. And you know, I got this story because when I was in north of Thailand in Medang province, and that's in Chiang Mai, I was staying in this beautiful cave, and a very deep cave with lots and lots of bats. And because the bats would fly in and fly out, they'd always do their toilet just on the way in or on the way out. Which meant just outside the cave, there was this beautiful, was a papaya tree. And I must admit, in all the years I've been alive, I've never tasted a papaya so sweet as that particular papaya tree. Or the papayas from the tree. I never ate the tree, I ate the papayas. And the reason why it was so delicious was because of all the bats who poo on it. And I said, thank you, bats. Because that gave the papayas this special flavor. So, the meaning of that story, when someone criticizes you or treats you unfairly or whatever, instead of getting angry, you could actually just, oh, thank you for the extra dog poo. Because I can learn so much more from this. And number one, the people who try and upset you, they get even more upset. They get upset because you're not accepting the bad words. It's one of the sayings which the Buddha did, a more serious saying. He said, if somebody gives you a gift and you don't accept it, who does the gift belong to? If I didn't accept this, you'd have to take it home with you. Rather than, I like this, this is good. So I'm going to keep this. But so if you don't accept a gift, it has to go back to the original owner. So if somebody criticizes you or says wrong things to you and says terrible things to you, always remember, if you don't accept that, it has to go back to the one who said it. They're the ones who gets upset. And you go away smiling and happy without any problem at all. And as for them, karma gets them really bad. So always remember, if somebody treats you badly, I'll just let it go. Because karma will settle the score for them. And as for you, you just do it as a learning experience. And the learning experiences are just so wonderful. Oh, I don't know that. I remember just at an airport, I was talking to a man from the Middle East some years ago. And he's told me some of the worst things you could say to someone you don't like. And one of the worst curses in the Middle East, and I think you can understand the meaning why this is such a bad thing to say to somebody if you reflect upon it. It was a curse to say, may the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. I don't recommend you using that term to anybody. But you can see it does have a bit of class to it. May the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. But even more than that, and this is the more interesting part of the bad speech, because it was something very wise. He said, worse than that, the worst curse you can give in the Middle East was, may you get what you want as soon as you want it. And that made you really think, why was that worse? Because in your life, if whenever you want something, you get it immediately, with no work, it just comes to you straight away, then much of life would lose its meaning. And some of the things you want, if you get it straight away, you realize you didn't really want it anyway. So those are the sort of things which you hear. Why it is that people say these things? Because these are like teachings which have come from so many centuries of wisdom. May you get what you want as soon as you want it. Even little things. How many people here have won the lottery? The first prize? Not yet. You never want to. Honest. If ever you did win the lottery, then, oh, your life would change so badly. You get everything you want whenever you want it, and you'll have what's called the curse of wealth. You know what the curse of wealth is? You don't. Yes. I think you should do. Because sometimes we have the idea, once we get what we want, then we'll be happy. You find you're not. Everybody, apparently, who wins the lottery always buys another ticket the week after. Why? Because no matter how much it is, it's never enough. Yes. You always want more. And you have to keep it very secret. Otherwise, if your friends heard that you've just won the lottery, or if Ajahn Mudu hears you've just won the lottery, he said, oh, you know, we just need a bit of a donation for a new road. And you get harassed by everybody. That's why I still recall this article which someone sent to me from a British newspaper of a woman who did win the lottery. I think it was £42 million. That's a lot of pounds sterling. £42 million. And what she did next, she decided to buy a big mansion in Sussex so that she could enjoy, you know, some land, a big house. And 1 year later, she sold that mansion and moved back into a small house in some city somewhere. And why did you sell your house? What's wrong with having a mansion? And she said, it's because I could never find my kids or my husband. The size of the house was killing my family. Whenever I wanted to find my kids, they were in some wing of the house. Another kid was somewhere else in the house. My wife was in her part of the house. Or my husband was in one part of the house. It was such a big house, they never saw each other. Because they never saw each other, it was destroying their family. And so that's why they deliberately moved into a smaller house. They'd always see one another. Her kids, who she loved very much, they couldn't escape from their mum. And of course, you know, the kids loved their mum as well. And the husband and the wife, they were always together. They had to be together because it was a small house. And to this day, I always remember, because I did come from a poor family. My father was from Liverpool. My mother was from Stoke-on-Trent. He was really sick. We lived in a council flat. We were so poor, we'd always leave the door unlocked even when we went away, because we were quite hopeful. We were quite sort of hopeful that one day a burglar might come into our little flat and take pity on us and leave us a donation. But because of that, I would always see my parents. And they'd have arguments, like everyone else has arguments, and differences of opinion, but we'd see that. We'd see them argue. And I'd also see them make up afterwards, because there was no way they could escape from one another. The same as my brother and I. I've got a brother. I became a monk, he became a banker. Total opposites. But we love each other to bits. His name is Tony. It's his birthday next week. I've already sent him his birthday card. It takes a while to get there. But anyway, that we'd always share the same room. And we grew up together. So it didn't matter what you do. You become a monk, you become a banker. Because when you grow up together, you learn how to love one another. Yeah, we'd fight like young people would. We'd always have to make up because there was no other place to go. So sometimes when you live in a small place, you find that you have to get on together. You learn how to love and forgive and work together. I think it's one of the curses, please excuse me, it's one of the curses in our modern world, especially in Australia, that sometimes we think living in a big house is very good. But small houses are much more fun, much more loving. We have to learn so much more how to get on together. You've got no choice. So anyway, those are the sorts of things which you learn when you know, as long as you've got enough to eat. And sometimes if you haven't got that much in the kitchen, It's amazing just what you can put together with just simple stuff. And that is just where all just the new inventions of food come from. When there's not much and we innovate. I remember, I actually looked this up the other day, it was 1904 in St. Louis, Missouri, the St. Louis World's Fair. And many things were invented there, like the radio. I think one of the first radio signals from US to UK happened on that time. But also on that time, there was another thing which was invented. Does anyone know what that was? What happened? There were two food stalls next to each other. One was a store which was selling waffles. You know, American waffles, like pancakes, you know, in a waffle machine or whatever. And the next door, right next to it, was selling ice cream. And the two gentlemen, selling one ice cream, one selling waffles, they talked to each other day after day, week after week, and they decided to collaborate. And what they got was by putting a waffle with an ice cream on top, was an ice cream cone. And that's where the ice cream cone came from. Just from good luck, but one thing and another thing, being together and being able to innovate and join opposites together rather than keeping them apart. It's one of the reasons why that sometimes that when people are rich, they're separated. We can't see one another, meet one another. But when people are poor, it's amazing just how you have to depend upon one another. And even as monks, you know, we are, in a Buddhist monasticism, we are deliberately dependent. Venerable Mudo, he's a good cook. He can cook food for himself. He's got this lovely property at Elika. And, oh, Patrick, you can have a little garden, enough to grow some veggies for everybody. But do you do that? It's not allowed. You know why it's not allowed by the Buddha? To grow your own food, to store your own food, or cook your own food? Because if we did that, we'd be self-sufficient, independent. We'd be saying, we don't need you. And then we'd be like these monks or nuns who live in an enclosed monastery or convent, and you can't go in, they can't go out. Because we are dependent, deliberately, we're poor deliberately. That is why, so that we have this beautiful connection with you. We need you. You need us, I hope. You know, it's strange being a monk in Australia. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, thank you. Thank you. Because I am, have a guess how old I am. Who knows how old I am now? No. No, it's getting much better, yeah. No, I like to say I am 830 now. Honestly, I can't lie, I'm a monk. 830 months. It sounds more impressive when you're a monk to try and be older. Anyway, because I'm getting old now, that I qualify under Australian law for a senior citizen's card. Yeah, why not? So, you know, if you're over 65, I think you can get senior citizen's card. So I went on computer to apply for senior citizen's card and said, nope, you have to come in because it's something called identity fraud. I don't want to know who wants to steal my identity. But anyway, I had to go in there to prove who I was. So I went into the Centrelink office over in Armidale, southern suburb of Perth, and made an appointment. And they said, can you prove who you are? And I said, I've been a monk for 46 years and I still haven't found the answer to that question. That's a difficult thing to do, to prove who you are. So they said, well, no, stop making jokes. So, have you got ID? Let's see some ID. Let's see your driving license. I don't have a driving license. Been a monk for such a long time. Imagine if I did have a driving license. You drive so slow and mindfully and peacefully. So you create these great traffic jams everywhere. When somebody wanted to cut in front of you, you say, please, you go first. Out of kindness and compassion. So I haven't got a driving license. Says, oh, okay. Let's see your credit card. I don't have a credit card. Your bank account. Don't have a bank account. Let's see, what else did they ask for? Oh, the ownership of your house and your rates agreement. I don't own anything. Now, these are monasteries, and actually you can kick Venerable Mudita out any moment. You can kick me out any moment. I don't own anything. So you're only there because people respect you. But I didn't have any marriage. No, the next thing they asked for, you know, this is absolutely true. I didn't make this one up. They asked, let's see your marriage certificate. And when I stopped laughing after that, I said, look, I'm a monk, I haven't got a marriage certificate. I said, well, can you prove who you are? I said, I did have a passport. Is that all? I said, yeah. And he said, according to Australian law, Ajahn Brahm, you don't exist. I said, yes, the Buddha was right. I think I was giving this poor lady such a hard time. She said, oh, forget about it. She just gave me the card anyway. Sometimes, even at the airport, when you could go to airports, I mean, the international airports, they asked me, and I just cracked up laughing. I couldn't go any further. They said, have you got any hair gel in your bag? But a lot of the time, if you have kindness and fun with somebody, it's amazing just how it puts other people at their ease. And they never seem to get upset or angry at you. They just, sometimes you give you these things without any problem at all. You know, another weird thing which we have in Buddhism, I'm just rambling on a bit, but these are interesting things, is how you respond to the difficulties in life. Because one of the things of being a monk, I always have to be honest, 100% honest. So there was something which we have in Buddhism, which it's just like in many other religions, these relics. And there's this Burmese monk I met, he's actually over in Singapore, and the Burmese monk, he'd gone around many places in Burma, especially some of the remote jungle areas, looking for the ancient Buddha relics, because sometimes you get these bones and they actually put them in these big reliquaries, these big monuments, and they're very highly sought after. But over many, many years and centuries, some of these monuments, they fall over in the jungle, and this monk went around searching for them, and he found quite a few. And he came up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, you know, you're doing a good job in Australia. I want to give you some of these relics to bring back to Australia. So I thanked him very much. But then the problem comes when you actually bring them through customs in Australia. How can you declare them? So I put down, I have to be honest, so I put body parts. I did that. And of course, they come over here, sir. So what body parts have you got? I said, bones. Old bones. Let's have a look. And of course, they're in these very beautiful containers. So what bones are those? They're the bones of the Buddha. He said, it's too difficult for me. So he called the boss in, the supervisor. He said, what have you got in there? He said, bones. So whose bones? He said, no, 2,500 years ago, the Buddha's bones. He said, well, it's too difficult for me as well. Get out of here. And that's exactly what happened. So often, just like honesty and a kindness, people realize you're not sort of doing anything which is going to compromise biosecurity. And so they let you through without any problem at all. So instead of getting angry and upset when people give you a hard time, I always think it's a wonderful opportunity for another story to share with the people when I get to Albany. Another little tale you can tell people to make people happier. Another little way, instead of letting life make you even more suffering, more upset. There's other ways of looking at it. I'm going to finish off with this last little story. Supposed to do half an hour meditation. And then we do some questions afterwards, which I always think is the best. But this was a classic story where two sisters came to see me once for some marriage counselling. Now, first of all, why on earth do you ask a monk for marriage counselling when I've never been married? Weird, isn't it? And a lot of times people want blessings and advice from either priests or monks. Oh, you've been married before. Yeah. Wish you weren't, but never mind. We all make mistakes. I was more fortunate. I said this today. Some other Thai people gave me lunch today. And they said, how old are you? And I told them I was 838 or whatever, or 69. And they said, you don't look that old. And I said, it's true, because when I was in Bangkok a couple of years ago, I was asked that question. I said, no, you're making up. You can't be that old. How come you look so young? You know, my answer was straight away, said, I look young because I've never been married. She gets it. Yeah, she knows. Very good. No. So no worries. So anyway, where was I going with this? Oh yeah, these two sisters, they came together to speak to me. And the first one, so let's get some marriage cards. And the first one, oh, she had a husband causing her so much trouble. And, you know, trying to give some advice to them to try and make it so you can live together and support one another. Because look, you know, if you throw that one away and get another one, get a replacement. He said, they're all the same. But anyway, I was trying to sort of solve her problem. Not much success. But then I turned to her younger sister. You know what her problem was? That she was single. And she was trying to find a husband. She could never find one. Maybe go out for a couple of weeks or a month and it'd all fall apart. So she wanted some advice how to get a partner in life. And I gave them advice, but they didn't understand it. They wouldn't accept it. I said, well, look, your elder sister's got a husband she doesn't want. you understand the rest. It's illogical to me. But anyway, but in the end, then I got serious to them. I said, now, listen, you, the elder sister, have got a husband. You've got what we call married woman suffering. That's what it's like being married. You can't do what you want. You have to compromise, and sometimes it's very difficult. And if you get rid of your husband, get divorced or separated, you have what your sister has called single woman suffering. And I told the younger sister, if you get a husband, you won't have your single woman suffering anymore. You will have what your sister has. Have you ever noticed that? That when we change, we think, oh, when I become rich, then I won't have poor person suffering anymore. Correct. You have rich person suffering. If you get rid of your richness and you give it away to charity or you lose it all, you get poor person suffering and you want riches. Sometimes people think, oh, what if I become a monk? Then I won't have rich person, poor person or married suffering. No, you will have what we call monk suffering. Or nun suffering. So the point is, no matter what you do in life, what situation you are, rich, poor, female, male, young, old, whatever, it's what you make of what you have. That is always the secret of success in life. And if things just don't go right in life, you become sick. Just use a wonderful time of sickness to be able to understand about what this body is and how to look after it. It's really strange that when I was young in Thailand, I got a bit sick. And I had this terrible, what's called scrub typhus fever. And those days, I can't resist telling this story, scrub typhus, it's exactly the same as typhoid, but it was made by little mites in the forest floor. And because we'd meditate in the jungles, no one realized that in that area there was scrub typhus. Because all the local Thai people were immune. It's only the Westerners, the Pathurung, got the scrub typhus. And because they didn't know what it was. And in those days, in the part of Thailand where the hospital was really poor. So I had a very heavy fever. They put me in the hospital bed, the old-fashioned hospital ward, maybe 6 or 7 beds on either side. And then about 6 o'clock, the nurse disappeared. It was a monk's ward. And then I knew enough Thai to ask one of the other monks who was in the next bed, "Should we tell someone the night nurse hasn't come?" He looked at me and said, "What are you talking about, night nurse? There is no night nurse. If you get very sick at night time, it's just unlucky karma." That wasn't very reassuring when you were sick. And the next thing was, because they didn't know what sickness I had, they just give cocktail of antibiotics injected in your backside twice a day. I remember that with trauma. Now, people would always think that all these wonderful Thai nurses were just so beautiful and petite and delicate, but this was not Thai Airways, this was hospital. And this nurse, she was built like water buffalo. She was big. She had to be. Because in those days, remember the days of recyclable needles? They didn't use the needles just once. They, you know, put them and they sterilize them and use them I don't know how many times. And because this was a poor part, it was a third world country at the time, Thailand, and the northeast of Thailand, the Isan, it was a poor area. And the monks were, you know, the poorest of them all. So I was pretty sure that they used those needles many, many times in Bangkok, and then they posted them up to Ubon. And from Ubon, the last people got to use them were the monks. They were so blunt. Yeah, they were. And so that's why the nurse had to be very strong. Oh, that hurt so much. Twice a day, and all the compassion I had, that didn't last a couple of days. And I didn't like that nurse at all. But you learned so much. She was trying to do her best. But the interesting thing about that story was, you know, the way that fever eventually went. And sometimes, so we're going to do some meditation in a moment, but sometimes we don't realize how powerful meditation is. Because one of the first times when I got so weak and tired, fever for about 4 weeks, and I like scrub typhus, they didn't know what it was. Only later on we found out what it was. But I decided, I'm going to meditate. I'm going to learn how to just let things be and stop fighting the disease which was in my body at the time. And I think it was even during a fever, I was laying on my bed. I said, I'm going to totally let go and make my body peaceful and then my mind peaceful. And I did that. You got into a very still, beautiful state of meditation. So you couldn't feel your body, a lot of joy and happiness inside of you. When I came out afterwards, I'm pretty sure that that's the time when the fever broke. Because other monks have done that as well. And of course, you've done that many times since. Just using the power of meditation to create amazing health outcomes. Remember Ajahn Chah telling me that story that he had malaria for so many years. And he said that one day it was so bad, he was sitting there or laying down, he went right inside of it, like in a big forest fire, to the very center of it. Outside was hot, but inside was cool. And as he was staying there, inside the cool place, It's like the malaria fever got hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter, like an inferno. And then it got so hot it exploded. And that was the last time in his life he had malaria. Never got it again afterwards. These are little things which many people can do. And I say this because not everybody, but sometimes people get into situations in hospitals, in ICUs, and sometimes you give them some little bit of inspiration. They do this because they have to. And they do it and things heal amazingly. Oh, I think I can tell this story for you. There's this one young Sri Lankan girl, about 12 or 13. A young girl who was, you know, really good at school, very popular, you know, like a person full of life. But, you know, she had a deformed spine. And they realized something was wrong, but only when she started going through puberty that they found out that, you know, what the real problem was, this genetic deformity in her spine. And the doctors said the only way we could stop her spending the rest of her life in a wheelchair is to put this brace on her, which you would have to wear 24/7 for about a year or two. Now, I think you can understand, at that time of your life, a young boy, young girl, when just the opinion of your friends, your peers, is so important for you. A girl has to be beautiful, or at least popular. A guy has to be strong or something. And this was going to destroy that part of her life, which she had no choice. So she thought. So her mother, were you there at the time when this happened? I don't know. But anyway, brought her to monastery up in Serpentine. This beautiful girl, just full of energy and life. But, you know, she knew what was going to happen if she carried on wearing this brace. And if she didn't carry on wearing the brace, both were very difficult situations. So then, I taught her a little bit of meditation. And because she had to, she did it. And I was just so pleased when a couple of weeks later, her mother brought her. So what happened? She said she got so peaceful in the meditation, just watching her breathing. Got so still, she saw this beautiful blue light. We call these nimittas in meditation. It's beautiful blue light in a meditation. And I never instructed her to do this. It was almost like intuitively she did this. She imagined her spine. She'd seen it in the scans. She imagined her spine all twisted. And just she imagined straightening it up. And that's what she imagined. And then when the CT scan came out, they said, I'm sorry, there's been a mistake. You have to go back inside and take it again. They did it again. It was the same result. She straightened the top part of her spine. You know, how the heck did you do that? And you know, they showed me the photos of it. It's not imaginary. It was real. Just through the power of her meditation, she'd done something which was almost impossible, like a self-miracle, simply because she knew how to focus and use this beautiful light and inside the imaginary spine and straighten it out. And it worked. So meditation is very, very powerful. And sometimes you can do things like that. What a wonderful thing it is for such a small girl like that to get over this huge problem in her life of either just being a very unpopular iron lady at school and being criticized for all sorts of things. But she didn't need to do that. And I don't say that to you just to prove anything, except that these things are possible and they do work sometimes. So, started off with saying bad things and hopefully finishing off with inspiring things. I don't know why it is that many people say they listen to my talks at night time because it sends them to sleep. And I've already got my first couple of sleep. A nice kind voice. So, okay. So we can do some meditation now, if you wish. So, cures all sorts. You want to go to the toilet, you want to sit down or lie down or escape while you've got the chance. Yeah, okay, we can do some lights here. did a good job.
I tell them all the sayings,
mate. Yeah. This will be it, bastards, anyway. Oh, don't need to, that, don't seek revenge. Okie dokie. Oh, you do, okay, yeah. Very good. Are you ready? Okay, so guided meditation, 20 minutes or so. Is that okay, 20 minutes? Okay. Oh, it's amazing, so many places you can meditate. So some people are meditating in the toilet room. In fact, I don't really call it toilets anymore. I call it letting go room. Which is why it's a good place to meditate. So, you want to close your eyes when you're ready. And making you laugh before we meditate is an important part. So, I told Thai people today, one of the sayings of the Buddha is Sukhino Chittang Samadhiyati. From happiness, the mind becomes still. So if you can create a joyful mind to begin with. And once your mind is joyful, this is a guided meditation I've been teaching for a while, so please follow if you will. Become aware of your body, first of all. How are you sitting here? If you're sitting on a chair, how comfortable are your legs? Do you need to move your feet forward or tuck them more under the chair? How can you make your legs more at ease? This is starting the meditation off with what we call mindfulness together with kindness. Those two words together become kindfulness. You're just mindful without kindness. You're kind without mindfulness. It doesn't have any power. Put kindness and mindfulness together. It's powerful. So can you feel your legs? How do they feel? Do they need to be moved? Adjusted? And don't move further up the body until your legs are pretty comfortable. And when you think they are comfortable, then move up to your butt. How is your bottom feeling, pressed against the chair or the cushion? If you want to fidget, now is the best time. Just to adjust, I'm going to fidget even though I don't really need to. Just actually to show it's worthwhile to do. Then you move up to your back. Often I give my back a stretch at this time. Because I've seen animals in the forest, whether it's kangaroos, echidnas, they love stretching as well. And then I just let go and relax my back, trying to make sure that every part of it is as comfortable as I can possibly arrange it. I'm kind to my back. I'm aware of where that kindness on my back is best focused. To my back feels pretty comfortable. If you want to lean back on the chair or forward, it's pretty much up to you. Whichever feels right. Don't follow what you see is in the photographs or the statues. You are not the Buddha. So you may have injuries, so you sit comfortably as you possibly find the most comfortable. And then relax your shoulders. So sometimes I visualize my shoulders of being two groups of reeds or straw on either side of the spine being pulled apart, being stretched. And now I let go of both ends. So there's no stress in my shoulder muscles. It's loose, at ease. And I go down my arms to my hands and relax my hands. I can feel all the sensations, and it's very easy to relax hands because there's so many nerve endings, especially in the fingers. I'm really caring for my arms and hands as if I'm caring for a little child. I want to make sure they're as comfortable, as ease as possible. Then I go back up to this time my neck, make sure my head is well balanced on top of the neck, so there's not too much tension anywhere. And then when my neck is relaxed, I go to my face, because your facial muscles, they show so much of emotional turmoil. So I relax the muscles around my eyes, first of all. And then around my mouth, along my head, my forehead. So my whole face relaxes, and with it, many of the inner emotions also relax. I'm relaxing my whole body. Now I look upon my body, instead of in parts like the legs, the butt, the back, etc. I look upon it as one unit, one thing. Really relaxed to the max. If there's some part I've missed which needs some relaxation, I zoom in on it, like focus in on it, and find out how to relax it. A lot of time it's just with kindness. And my body feels very comfortable. And with that comfort of a relaxed body, it's delightful. It feels good. It feels happy. And I am aware of the delight of relaxation. When I feel that delightful relaxation, the level of relaxation goes deeper. It becomes very pleasant, even at this early stage of meditation, being aware of the delight of a relaxed body. My body is not causing any problem at all. I can feel I can sit here for hours now. I developed mindfulness and kindness on my body. Now I'm going to take it deeper onto the mind. Instead of wondering what the mind is, I'm just going to ask, how peaceful are you right now? Just like we have a thermometer to judge the temperature of this room, or a speedometer on your car as you go home to know how fast you are traveling. There's something we call peaceometer. How peaceful are you? Given a number from 1 to 10, 1 means really peaceful, 10 means very agitated. You just need to tell yourself, so you can be honest, how peaceful are you, or how agitated are you right now? Now keep being aware of that peaceometer. How can you make yourself more peaceful? Just being in this moment. No past, no future. Just being now. And being kind. Caring for this moment. Being at ease in this moment. You find the reading on your piezometer goes down, down, down. As you become more and more peaceful. What are you aware of? What are you mindful of? The reading of your piezometer. You know how peaceful you are. You know how when you relax the mind, it becomes even more peaceful. And peace, like a body which is at ease, peace is also very, very delightful. You go thinking about the future, how many more minutes are left, or what to do afterwards. You destroy peace. Now is where your future is being made. This is the only time you ever have. So make this moment peaceful. And your health and happiness would increase. And often at this point, just quite naturally, people become aware of their breathing. It's one of the only things which is still moving. Just watching the breath come into your body, watching it go out. Just like you're going to the beach, sitting down on a calm day, and just watching the ocean waves come in and recede away. You can't control them. Just watch them. The breath, the air just coming into your body and just falling away again. You're not controlling, not wanting anything, just watching. Letting go, not driving the car or giving any instructions. The car is your body, your mind. You're just really being a passenger. I will be quiet for about 3 or 4 minutes now, so you can enjoy, hopefully, the peace on your piezometer. Just letting things be. Not controlling. In this moment, you can be quiet. We reach in the silence, not giving things a name. Coming to the end of the meditation now. How do you feel inside? How peaceful are you? And how joyful and pleasant is peace of mind? I'm now going to ring the gong 3 times. Good. Here we go. So now it's the time for some questions and answers. But just to get things started, to get your brain moving again. So did you hear about the young boy who wrapped himself up in gift wrap? You know why he did that? He wanted to live in the present. People groan when you tell jokes like that, but they can't wait to tell their friends and partners tomorrow at work. Okay. Any questions people have about what was said tonight or what was not said? You mean you're all enlightened? Wow. Hi. How's your knee?
It's very good. It was very peaceful meditation. My knee just didn't cause any problems because my mind was peaceful.
That's a very good question, Chris, and a very good answer too. A lot of times, you see sometimes people are playing football and they've got a broken leg because they're not even thinking about it. They don't feel it. So sometimes, when the mind is very peaceful and kind and still, you don't feel any problems. It heals up by itself. It's one of the reasons why they have people that go to hospitals and doctors, not to actually to cure people, but to tell them jokes and act funny. And that actually increases their healing. So sometimes lifting up people's emotional spirits is a wonderful therapy. I notice many nurses who have told me that sometimes there's so much work they have to do, so many pieces of paper they have to fill out, they don't have time like in the old days. They can sit next to somebody, just hold their hand, and just talk to them with kindness. Because the kindness is a wonderful therapy. Yes?
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for that beautiful meditation and your story. My name is Amy.
Hi, Amy.
Hello. I've been looking forward to you coming to visit. So I've heard very good things, and so far, so good. So things in a meaning crisis. This is just an interpretation.
Yeah.
As individuals, what do you recommend people can do in order to find more meaning on a personal level, but also as a collective or a community?
Yeah. You know, one of the most powerful, easy ways to find meaning is caring for somebody. It's actually giving, serving, rather than wondering about getting anything. You always get so much more happiness and fun and joy when you serve someone and give to someone. That's how I find meaning on a Sunday night in Albany, by sitting up here giving and telling old jokes and just smiling and sharing the moment. And that gives enormous meaning. Such simple things. And little by little we realize that some people in our world, it's just, we're always too concerned about what's in it for me. Instead of what can I give for others? How much can I serve? How much can I give? You know, we have this tradition, all the duties and jobs which we have to do in monasteries, especially big monasteries, sometimes people want us to roster it all out and have schedules, and you all have to do the washing the toilets today, you have to do the sweeping today. But you know what happens over in monastery which I'm supposed to run? Whoever gets there first can do that duty. It's not a duty anymore, it's a privilege. It's a wonderful job to be able to wash somebody's bowl for them or something. You get so much happiness and fun out of that, at least I do. I may be a bit crazy, but if I could open the door for someone so they can go out, wonderful. Even you're supposed to open the door for me. But often, how many times often open the door for you? Heaps of times. And that's where you get lots of meaning in life. From how much you can serve and how much can you give. And you find that there are some people, especially in places which are much worse off, unfortunately, than Western Australia, they give so much time, so much effort, so much sacrifice. So why do you do that? I said, we love doing it. See if you can give us more to give, to serve, to do for others. It's not what's in it for you anymore. It's on how much you can give and serve and offer. And there are times when, and it's true that sometimes that over in Perth I might give a talk on a Friday night, finish off about maybe 10 o'clock, go to the airport, get the overnight flight to Singapore and then give another retreat there the whole day. It's crazy life. But you don't get tired when you're giving. You find so much meaning in there. And sometimes just one person comes up to you, just one person, says, thank you for what you said in that talk last year. It changed my whole life. Thank you so much. Well, if you could see this is real, the tears in that mother's eyes when she was showing just how that little meditation had straightened up her girl's spine. Real. And that, you know, that inadvertently I taught her how to do that. She was good at it. She could do it. Just even me thinking about it now, because all the meaning in the world to me. And you've done many little things like that yourself as well. That's where you get meaning. So whenever there's any sort of problems like COVID, or there's any problems like, economies or difficulties in your marriage or somebody else's marriage, there's wonderful opportunities to care for one another. And you find so much meaning in such of the most simple parts of your life. You know, you see a little kid over there, fast asleep. There's so much meaning in that. And the beautiful sounds. Because we're not allowed to listen to music as monks. It's any time we listen to any music. So it's wonderful. So you can get angry at those sorts of stuff, but no, why? It's wonderful. Yeah. See? Thank you for... Please repeat it. Yeah. So, yeah. How many times have you done that? I don't have a mobile phone, so I can't do that, but... How many times have you done that? It's just mistakes happen in life, so we laugh at mistakes. We never sort of get angry at them. It wasn't your fault anyway, it's your mobile phone's fault. Turn your mobile phone off. Turn it off. Naughty phone. Don't do that again. Yeah.
I'm curious, why don't
Why are they allowed? Because a lot of times then you'll start getting into the latest trends of music, and sometimes you try and dance. I'm a terrible dancer. So you can't. Instead of listening to, I used to be into my musical taste. It started off with rock, with people like Jimi Hendrix. I used to love rock. And growing up in London, I used to go to great rock concerts. I'm going to tell you about my rock concerts I went to. We had this one in North London, in 2 hours of Jefferson Airplane, then 2 hours of The Doors, then another 2 hours of Airplane, another 2 hours of Doors. This was just in the 60s. Yeah, there's in the Roundhouse in Chalk Farm, I think. And amazing. So 8 hours of all this incredible music. I had a private concert with Roger Stewart once when he was hardly known. There's only 6 or 7 people came to the stuff. So I used to love really heavy music when I was young. And then later on, you started getting in more into like classical music. It's much more refined and more peaceful. And then later on, as when I became a monk, you started getting into just like the music of the wind in the trees, or the rain sort of dripping off the leaves after a monsoon storm. The sounds of nature became even better music. And after that, just the sounds of stillness. So sometimes in monastery, there's no one there in the afternoon. And it can be so quiet. And I listen to that. And sometimes if you go on.
So would the human creativity towards music be then considered distraction?
Yeah, it would be distraction, but there's nothing wrong with it. You know, we're not going to put you in a prison for listening to music. It's just sometimes that there's better music on offer. And so you always, I tend to just, whatever's better, you go for that. And just going into like nature, a calm place of nature. That's why I mentioned this to someone some years ago, and they thought I was really weird and crazy, but I don't like sort of oceans because they're too noisy. Forests are much better, but even better than forests are caves. I live in a cave. And it's so peaceful in there. You did that hailstorm. I just managed to hear the hailstorm. It's very rare to hear any sound of the weather inside a cave. It's so quiet in there. That's the best music, which I'm being honest with you. I love that music. The silence.
It's more conducive to meditation.
Oh, yeah.
Because I mean, laughter, singing, it's fairly universal.
Yeah.
And that's a melody.
Yeah. There's also, you see me laugh a lot already and to speak a lot. But the best music of all is totally free and silent. And one of the nice things about going into nature, and I sometimes wonder, why did I like classical music? And one of the reasons was that while that classical music was going on, I wasn't thinking. If I tried to say anything or think anything, I would miss part of the symphony or whatever. And then it stopped me thinking. And all of those of you who try to meditate, you've got all these thoughts coming in the mind. How can you stop that? You notice whenever you listen to music, you're not thinking. Very good, quiet music, inspiring music. But it's the same that you trained yourself when you're listening to just the wind blowing. You don't think anything, you just listen to the sounds. And then later on, when it's totally silent, the silence is so delightful, so beautiful, you don't need to think. So you get the inner quietness. And that sort of inner silence. There's that famous story of Lao Tzu, which I repeat so often, but I haven't found a better one. He would go on a walk every evening with one of his disciples. But when they went on a walk, they'd have to keep absolute quietness, no talking. And this one disciple, a young man, they went on a walk together. They came to a ridge in the mountains at sunset. It was a gorgeous sunset. And the young man couldn't help himself saying, "Look at that beautiful sunset." He'd broken a rule by speaking. So Lao Tzu turned around, went back to the temple. And once he got back, he said, "That young man can never go on a walk with me ever again." So that's a bit strict. He only made one little mistake. Anyway, what's wrong with saying what a beautiful sunset? He said, because once he said what a beautiful sunset, he wasn't watching the sunset anymore. He was only watching the words. He wasn't watching the sunset. He was painting a picture instead of just being with it. We can't capture the beauty of nature, not with a photograph. You can come close sometimes, not with words, although poets can, sometimes they can manufacture almost a real thing, but it's never as good as if you're actually by the stream when it's flowing. When you're at the dawn, the sun's coming up. Those things you can't paint, you can't photograph. You can only take a fraction of what's happening. But when you're silent, it's like your whole mind and being is open for what's happening. That's why the silent awareness is the best music of all. Does that make any sense? Okay. Good, yeah. Good. I thought everyone was going to be silent for a moment.
More electrical,
yeah.
Type question. It's hypothetical. If somebody's practicing Buddhist and they're in the medical world and they have a patient who's in a coma and has no chance of recovery.
Yes, yeah.
How would someone approach that if they were sort of killing? Or?
No, it's a good question. It's something which comes up often. It's not just with someone in a coma. It's why, you know, your dear cat or dog is very, very sick. And this one lady. I've told this to so many people that it's not a stupid question. So not a stupid answer. It's, if it's say your cat has got cancer and the vet says, look, it's suffering, we have to put it down, what do you do? And then you ask your cat what it wants. Take it aside, spend a little time with it by yourself and your cat and ask it. You get a great answers. And this girl, her name was Judy, she had a dog. Dog had cancer, spent so much money trying to, you know, look after the dog, as you do. She couldn't really afford it, but she did anyway, out of love for a pet who loved her. And the vet said, we've got to put it down, give it the injection. And she remembered what I told her. She took it aside, looked into the dog's eyes, held it so gently, said, now, have you had enough? Do you want to go? She got this clear message back. The dog said, no. I don't want to die yet. And so she took it back to the vet and said, no, I'm taking it home. And the vet knew she was a Buddhist and said, you Buddhists, you're supposed to be kind. You're really cruel. That dog is really suffering. But no, she took it home. And she brought the dog to the vet again 6 months later when it made a full recovery all by itself. And the vet said, you Buddhists are so wise. But the point was, sometimes the dog knows. It's not your right, your job, to kill that dog or cat, but it's a dog's or cat's job to make that choice. And if that's your dog and you love it and you listen to it and you can feel it, then you'll know the answer. And that's the same if it's, you know, your relation or someone you've been looking after in hospital. You know, you hold their hand or you sit next to them and ask them, do you want to go? A lot of time they're already gone. They're in a coma, but they're basically their life, they're what we call in Buddhism, the stream of consciousness has already left. You can feel that. And sometimes you feel that you're not killing anybody. They're already gone. So the important part of them has already left. So that solves the problem, and it's not that hard to do.
On the other side of that.
Yeah.
If somebody is very ill.
Yeah.
And you're using all your energy to keep them
alive. Yeah.
Alive.
Yeah.
You know, and they really
don't want to. Yeah.
They want to go.
Yeah. So yeah, this is the other. I like telling stories because these are real anecdotes and they answer the question much better than just a theory. This was a nurse, a husband. They were both young, maybe in their early 30s. He got a cancer. His name was Steve. And he was getting sicker and sicker. I was visiting them every other day, counseling them, trying to help them through the inevitable death. But then he was getting so thin, so weak, and the doctors couldn't figure out why he hadn't died yet. And so I remember going to see them and seeing he looked so much suffering, so thin. And then he figured it out. I asked the wife, said, have you given Steve permission to die yet? And I always remember this because it was one of those beautiful moments which I'll never forget. She never answered me. She just jumped up on the bed and put her arms around her husband, so gently, looked into his eyes with the love of two people still very, very much in love, and said, Steve, it's okay, you can go. And that's all he said. And he died that night. And you can understand that that was what was needed. Because if this is somebody you really, really love, you don't want to hurt them. He was staying alive because the last thing he wanted to do was to cause his wife grief. So all she needed to do was say, it's okay, Steve, you can go. And that's all he needed, and then off he went. And that works a lot of times. So if that's the case, you really love somebody very, very much, and they're so sick. And you don't know why they haven't died yet. Just ask them, look, it's okay by me, the rest of the family as well. You've lived a wonderful life, we'll never forget you, but you can't live in this body for too much longer, so time to go. With our permission. And it's a beautiful time. You ever notice that very often when people die in hospitals, they die when the family has left the bedside to go and get something to eat? And so on. Because they don't want to upset people. If they start to go through the dying process as if they're facing, no, don't go now, don't. So they said, we'd rather do it alone. It's a very private moment, death. And nothing to be afraid of either. Imagine a person's got this whole body, it's falling apart. What do you want to keep that one for? It's like driving an old bomb of a car and you've got plenty of good karma in the bank to buy a new one. Get a better model next time. Yeah.
With the music thing that we were discussing as you were talking on further, I sort of got the overall sense that realistically the less sound it was bringing in more peace.
Yeah.
To, you know, the meaning of meditation and life as it is naturally.
Yeah. Because peace is so hard to find. And there's plenty of music around. And you go in shopping centres, in sometimes in airports, there's always just things just hitting your senses all the time. And just having a quiet room. I remember the first time in Perth Airport, there was like a meditation room. I thought, great! I went in there to sit. It says, please do not leave your baggage unattended. Please, all passengers on the next flight, please report. And it was terrible. So disappointing. But I think you know what I mean. Sometimes, and what was the other story which comes to my mind? Our local building surveyor in Serpentine, Jarrowdaleshire, just the day he was retiring, he came to see me. And he said, Ajahn Brahm, I just wanted to come and say thank you for your car park. And what are you talking about? That's crazy stuff to say. Thank you for a car park. He said, yeah, I never told you, but every time I got stressed out at work, I just drove to your car park, in the monastery. Never got out of the car, never told anyone I was there, and just sat there with the windows open quietly, enjoying the peace. He said that took away all the stress and made me survive the job of being the chief building officer of the Shire Serpentine Gerarda. So thank you so much for your car park. It wasn't so much the car park, it was the peace of the monastery, just going there, just not being taught anything or being given any instructions, being able to sit and being accepted and being peaceful. And that worked immensely. But you know, sometimes some music can be very inspiring. So you're not saying you should never listen to any music at all, but sometimes it's a bit too much, I reckon. And some inspiring music would be wonderful. It happens, and many sort of animals, birds, even insects. Is it cruel to kill insects? Because sometimes that you see, living in a forest, see the intelligence of so many forms of life. Even little insects. Years ago, I don't know if Barry was here when this happened, but there was an ant's nest next to one of the huts which I built. I made very sure that that ant's nest was not disturbed at all, even though it took me much, much more work to go around rather than over. And I was the first person who lived in that sort of, it was an A-frame building. And the ants would never come in because I cared for them. But then one day another, it was like a layperson, they drove the tractor over that ant's mound. From that day on, they repaired the mound very quickly. They're very smart. From that time on, they started coming into the hut. It's amazing. Just as you were saying, just how many tiger snakes and stuff are at Ellicott Monastery. But they'll never harm you if you're kind to them. And I say that with a lot of carefulness. You don't sort of go tick them under the chin or anything. That's not being kind to them. Just know you leave them alone and look after them. They'll always look after you.
The Pope says we should be very kind to animals.
Yeah.
It's sad that we eat them.
Yeah, if we can avoid it, it's wonderful if it's possible. Some people can't. But, sometimes what's even worse than that is like blowing up their habitats, because we want to put a big road somewhere. There's so many other places where we cause a lot of suffering for other people, unnecessarily. So we can live a little bit simpler. Well, it's one of the great things about COVID. Because, we haven't been able to advance civilization. They call it advancing civilization so easily. You can't go anywhere. There's always terrible things happen with COVID as well. But there's always some nice parts to whatever happens in life. We were talking about, was it someone earlier today? I think, in the car coming through with Barry probably. But during the time there was a big plague in London in 1660s, then that was actually followed by a big fire. And the fire was, many people got killed, lots of property was lost. But because of the fire, whole central London was totally destroyed. But that's where they had the opportunity to put in a sewage system in London. They would never have been able to do that unless that tragedy happened. So the sewage system, which is in London right now, was basically started in 1666 or something, after the Great Fire. So there's always opportunities happen when tragedies occur. So it's sad when things happen, but it's also great opportunities to learn and find out what's really important in life. When you have a loved one who passes away, What does it teach you? It's sad. You'd rather they never disappeared. But it teaches you so much more about, you know, the meanings of life. I often tell people, just almost 9:30 now, my own father's death. He died when I was 16 years of age in a small, you know, council flat, which we left the door open to so burglars could make donations. But he died, and I never cried when he died. I never cried since. I've never felt sad that he died, which was weird for a 16-year-old to think like that. It was only many years later when I became a monk and I had the chance to understand how I felt. You know, the death of your own father. But I realized that I looked at his life in a different way. I loved him very much. He was a very kind father. But I remember the feeling going out of the crematorium after the service was completed. It was so similar to going out from one of those great concert halls in London after a musical performance. I felt the same emotions. Because after a great performance of music, the concert was over. And I'd never be able to hear it again. It never made me sad. I never cried after a great performance. I always thought how lucky I was to have been there. I wouldn't have missed that for the world. Thank you, Dad. So after his death, that's how I felt. I felt like giving him a round of applause, not a round of tears. I learned so much from those experiences. So you miss people. But you say, thank you for being my dad for those so many years. I'd rather had 60 years as my dad. But 60 years was better than 6. Thank you so much. And that's actually how we look at life. In a positive way. You may have a terrible, terrible back. If your back wasn't so bad, you wouldn't have been so close to the monks. So you look at life in a positive way, and it gives it that meaning you're asking about. So anyway, is that enough, or do you want some more questions? Yeah? Please stop me when you want to. Yeah? Yeah.
But they don't have comprehension and
yeah.
Can't remember. Are they actually leaving?
Like not yet.
Grieving goes on for a long time. When they die, it's sort of like you've done so much grieving already.
Yeah. That's dementia is, and I've given talks at conferences on dementia. And there's one conference I gave. It was over in Singapore. And the doctor, the expert, the professor of dementia in Singapore, he came on first of all, and he said one of the signs of dementia are that, you know, you can't really remember your past, you can't plan for the future, and you're socially disengaged. And I said, that's just like me. That's all I teach other people to do. So Buddhist monks teaching meditation, we're part of the cause of dementia. But the other part which is interesting in dementia, and this happens more often than people record, is they've got something which is called terminal lucidity. You heard that word before? You look in the medical dictionaries, it's there. Terminal lucidity is the phenomena that when somebody's either in a coma, or they've got terrible pain, or in dementia, that the last moments of their life, they wake up. You may be with your mum and she hasn't recognized you for the last 3 years. And then you're by her bedside, she's very sick, about to die. She says, hey, where have you been? And how are you? And how's this kid and that kid? And they just remember everything at the very end. It's called terminal lucidity. And when I just, in the hospital, I was just giving a conference and again asked all the doctors and nurses, how many of you have experienced that personally? And about a third of them put their hand up. They were there at the time when the person it was one of the doctors over in Perth. He told me that he was on duty, one of his patients, cancer, started the dying process earlier than he'd expected. So he ran to the bedside. He was dying. There's no way to revive her. So he also knew that in the drawer next to her bed was the telephone book with all her relations in. So one by one, this is your sister's doctor here. She's dying. Come to the hospital straight away, okay? And the next one, and got her daughter, I think Julie. Julie, your mum's dying, so please come straight away. And then the person opened their eyes up. The mum opened her eyes and said, tell Julie how much I love her. And then she passed away. And she'd been in a coma for days or something. And that is, and they said, that was just a beautiful experience to actually to see that, witness it. It happens. So it's only a temporary fog. And basically, at the very end of their life, if you're fortunate to be there at the time, and fortunate that they're one of these people who can express themselves at the end, then that just gives you a different idea of what dementia really is. Yeah. Just like that book Awakenings by Oliver Sacks or something. Very similar. People are just in coma for weeks, years. And if I keep on talking like this, you may be... Is there any last question before we finish off? Going?
One.
Okay, yeah.
Your previous life, you were a physicist.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Did that have any bearing on you becoming a Buddhist?
Yeah. And it was... I can't help but also mention one of my best friends. His name is Bernard Carr, C-A-R-R. He was Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Physics at Queen Mary College in London. He was featured on the film with Stephen Hawking because he was one of Stephen Hawking's really close associates, one of the inner circle. And he's also a Buddhist. And this is Bernard Carr. And he's also, he's now president of the Psychic Research Society in London, investigating ghosts, psychic phenomena, and stuff like that, and really getting some very interesting results. Real stuff. This is not crazy stuff. This guy is Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Physics, investigating ghosts and psychic phenomena, weird stuff. And that's actually why... Now, he was one of my best friends when I was at university, and it still is. Excellent. And that is wonderful. You weren't scared at all. He was just coming to make sure you're okay.
Yeah.
There's many stories like that. And I don't know why people are afraid of ghosts. Ghosts can be very, very helpful. Okay, one last story quickly. There is one of my friends. He was just a builder's labourer in Perth some years ago. Builder's labourer, last person on site on a Friday afternoon. And so he was just cleaning up, and he heard the sound by this old building in Mount Lawley. And the sound was, put your hand under here. Put your hand under here. And first of all, there's no one else around. He thought he'd imagined it. So he went to walk off, but then he heard it once more, very clearly, put your hand under here. So he's a young man, so why not? So under the house, he put his hand, there was a tin box under it. He pulled out the tin box, and there was about, $8,000-$9,000 in there. The reason why they were renovating the house was the previous owner never liked paying tax, and he died. That's where he hid his money. And the ghost, wanted this fellow, Ron, that's Bianca's partner, wanted him to have the money. And he said that's where they got the first deposit for their house. I don't know if it was 8,000 or 12,000 or something, but a huge amount of money in those days. And that's how they got started out in the house together. So if you do see any ghosts like that, please ask them, where's the money? And because you heard it from here, 10% has to go to the Anglican Monastery. Thank you for listening. Very good. Okie dokie.